Now, beginning in chapter 3, he continues to show about the conditions that are going to prevail as a result of the Babylonian captivity. What's going to happen whenever these people are taken into captivity? What's going to be the picture? What's going to be the change in their life and their way of deporting themselves? Well, he says in the first verse, "For behold, the Lord of hosts, doth take away from Jerusalem and from Judah the stay and the staff, the whole stay of bread, and the whole stay of water." Now, this phrase, the stay and the staff, has been translated several ways. One of these is a feminine word, and one is a masculine word. And it really probably just means the feminine and the masculine support are the weaker and the stronger support. The stay and the staff are just supports. Then he goes on to say, and the stay, whole stay of bread and the whole stay of water, that is their support from the most elemental and basic foods of bread and water, that's going to be taken away. The mighty man and the man of war, the judge, the prophet, and the prudent, and the ancient, the captain of 50, and the honorable man, and the counselor, and the cunning artificer, and the eloquent orator. Now this is what he's going to take away. Now if we turn over here to 2 Kings 24, verse 14, he describes there also, just like Isaiah has, what is taken away. And he carried away all Jerusalem. Now this is the captivity. He carried away all Jerusalem and all the princes and all the mighty men of valor, even 10,000 captives and all the craftsmen and smiths. None remained save the poorest sort of the people of the land. Nobody was left behind except what he describes here as the poorest sort of the people of the land. So all of the high and the mighty, all of the rich, all of the well-educated, those are the ones that were carried away. And that's why, you know, in studying the book of Daniel, we pointed out how that Daniel was a man of a high order, quite possibly even close to royalty. And he was one that was carried away also. And still in 2 Kings 24, the next verse, 15, and he carried away Jehoiachin to Babylon, and the king's mother, and the king's wives, and his officers, and the mighty of the land, those carried he into captivity from Jerusalem to Babylon. And all the men of might, even 7,000, and craftsmen, and smiths, 1,000, all that were strong and out for war, even them the king of Babylon brought captive to Babylon. So we see how that 2 Kings bears this out. So now back to Isaiah 3, verses 2 and 3 again. Now the mighty man and the man of war, the judge, the prophet, the prudent, and the ancient, the captain of 50, and the honorable man, the counselor, the cunning artificer, and the eloquent orator. All of the persons who were capable of productivity, it seems, whether it be war, whether it be what he calls a cunning artificer, whether it be somebody who could make an eloquent speech, whether it be somebody who was aged and full of wisdom, whether it be somebody who was prudent, all of these persons were carried away captive into Babylon. Now, if you can just stop and think for a moment what that would do to the city of Jerusalem and to the country of Judea, it wouldn't leave them very much, because a community and a nation is only as strong as the persons who live there. Then in the place of that, verse 4. Now you know, when we studied in Daniel, we alluded to the fact that these last two or three kings that they had in Judah tried to carry on the government, and they were overthrown and just really made a big mess of things, even trying to carry on a government. Well, he says here in verse 4, and I will give children to be their princes, and babes shall rule over them. So in the succession of the kings, and in the change of the order of things, he describes here as having children and babes being the princes and the rulers. And you can imagine how far a country would progress with that kind of a leadership. And the people shall be oppressed, every one by another, and every one by his neighbor. The child shall behave himself proudly against the ancient, and the base against the honorable. Now, we think a lot of times of this oppression, you know, is coming strictly from a group of foreigners. Only the Babylonians caused oppression. But that's not what he says here. He says the people shall be oppressed, every one by another, and every one by his neighbor. That is, if the condition would get so bad until each other would be the cause of oppression, and the neighbors would cause oppression. And then he says that the child shall behave himself proudly against the ancient. This is the young rebelling against the old. You know, that may be considered to be the generation gap, of course. We may think today that we're the first people who discovered this thing known as generation gap. But it's been in existence all along. Way back even before this, whenever the kingdom was divided, it was because Rehoboam would not submit to the counsel of the old men when his father Solomon died. And so there was rebellion. He rebelled against the counsel of the old men, and Jeroboam was allowed to come in then and take 10 tribes away from them and divide the kingdom. So there's always been this thing of rebellion, this concept of the younger generation not taking the counsel of the older generation. And so that's what happened when Israel was at its very lowest ebb. The child shall behave himself proudly against the ancient, and the base against the honorable. Now the base is the lower class or lower order, maybe the ignorant, the uneducated or unintelligent. They would then begin to rebel and turn against the honorable. That is, the person who was of a higher class. Now in verse 6 and 7 we have some strange wording here, but I think we can get the meaning of this. When a man shall take hold of his brother of the house of his father, saying, "Thou hast clothing, be thou our ruler, and let this ruin be under thy hand." Now, what he's talking of here is a man that would take his brother, or else somebody who is closely associated with him, and he would tell this brother, he said, "Well, you've got clothing, you've got position, you've got some wealth, why, you be the ruler, and let this ruin be under thy hand." That is, let you be responsible for what's happening in this country. You be the ruler. Now, to be a ruler in this day and time, and to really carry out the dignity of the office, you had to have enough wealth and possession to be able to bestow gifts on other people, on other rulers and other others that might visit you. And these the gifts commonly given were, if not some kind of precious stone, would be clothing. Because they all wore similar clothing, or that is, the styles didn't change that much, so you could just heap a lot of clothing and use it to give as gifts to others. So the time would come when they'd just be trying to pass the rulership on to most anybody who would take it. The man would say to his brother, "You be a ruler, and you let this ruin be under thy hand. In that day shall he swear, saying, I will not be a healer." In other words, this man that tried to give the rule to won't take it. Now, this word healer comes from the old English word, which was leech. And the word leech was the word used for physician. And as I understand, this word leech was used for a physician because it was thought that one of the best ways to cure nearly any problem was to let blood, to bleed somebody. You know, originally a barber bled people. That's why the barber pole's red and white. And did what they call a phlebotomy. But the physician, instead of bleeding many times, would take these leeches and put on the body, stick them on the body, and they would suck the blood out. And so if somebody was sick and they wanted to get rid of some blood, they'd put the leeches to him and let the leeches suck the blood out. I understand from hearsay, I don't know if it's true or not, that they even did this when Stalin was sick, and just before he died, they put leeches on him to deplete some of his blood. So the word leech was a word for physician, but then this word healer is a word derived from the word leech. So the man said, I will not be a healer. That is, I'll not take unto me the responsibility for trying to recuperate the vast fallen nature of this nation. For in my house is neither bread nor clothing. Make me not a ruler of the people. He will resist taking the job because he said, I don't have the things you think I have. I don't have enough bread or clothing to bestow gifts on others and to do honor to this position of ruler. So don't make me a ruler. Now, you know, that seems rather strange to us that conditions could get that bad in a land, because I've never been in a place where they didn't all have a lot of people who wanted to be ruler. When they start to run for an office, there's always somebody who wants the office. And there's usually somebody else that are trying to challenge them to get it, so that there's a race, there's a fight for it. Maybe there's several who are trying to get the office. But Jerusalem and Judea were so bad that you couldn't give the rulership to anybody. They wouldn't take it. Don't make me a healer. I'll not be a ruler. For Jerusalem is ruined, and Judah is fallen, because the tongue and their doings are against the Lord to provoke the eyes of His glory. Now there's just so much basic wisdom in this little statement right here. Just anybody could see Jerusalem is ruined and Judah is fallen. There's nothing left to rule. Why? Why did this happen? Because their tongue and their doings are against the Lord. Now, this is what the Lord regards about us: our tongue and our doings, our actions, our works. That's what the Lord is looking at. And I don't care what kind of a doctrine we have. I don't care what kind of belief we have. I don't care if we're a member of the true church. When we start having the wrong doings, and when we start having the wrong thing come from our tongues so that it's against the Lord, then we are setting ourselves up for ruin. If not literal physical ruin, then certainly spiritual ruin. And I can't help but remember the case of the church at Ephesus, in which he told them, unless you repent and turn again and do the first works, I'm going to take the candlestick out from you. You'll cease to be a church. So they're against the Lord to provoke the eyes of His glory. Now some of the translators say that this word eyes of His glory should be translated as clouds of His glory, as though the cloud were the thing in which God overshadowed the people with, in which He was protecting them, and so this would provoke this cloud. But whether it's cloud or eyes doesn't change the meaning or the force of it. It's an embarrassment to God for the people to turn against Him like these people did. Now in verse 9, the show of their countenance doth witness against them. The show of their countenance. Now when you talk about somebody's countenance, you're talking about the way they look. Either their face or their dress, their appearance, the way that they conduct themselves. And he says that these people, their countenance was of such a nature that it did witness against them. And you know, I think, and I don't believe this is just imagination, but I think that today you can look at many people who live a wicked life, who live ungodly, and their features, the expression on their face, their very mode of conduct betray them. It gives them away. There is, for example, the look of the harlot that just nobody else has. There's the look of the thief. Somebody's robbing you. You think he can have a pleasant look on his face, or a look that would go with the dignity of being a Christian? Just not really. And so he's saying that these people look the part. The show of their countenance doth witness against them. They were even looking like people that didn't follow God. They looked like people who were opposed to the thing God wanted. And they declare their sin as Sodom. They hide it not. Woe unto their soul, for they have rewarded evil unto themselves. While these people, their sin was so apparent that they were just as flagrant about sin as Sodom was. And Sodom certainly didn't hide its sin. They couldn't find 10 righteous people in Sodom. And so here God's people were just that bad. And so he says, for they have rewarded evil unto themselves. That is, their works, their fruits, the things they've been laying up in store for themselves that you're going to be rewarded with is evil. You know, that's really the way it is whenever we deserve to have evil. Certainly in the end of time, if our lot is that to be given evil, it'll be because we reward it to ourselves. We laid up for ourselves treasures on earth and not in heaven. And so the result of that is going to be evil. Say ye to the righteous that it shall be well with him, for they shall eat the fruit of their doings. Now there still are some that were righteous. And there would apparently always be some that were righteous. And again, we quote to you the example of Daniel. Daniel was among these captives, but we have no evidence to think that Daniel didn't try to live and didn't live a righteous life. As a matter of fact, we saw examples in the book of Daniel in which Daniel would not compromise. The three Hebrew children that were with him, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they also would not compromise. They wouldn't bow to the image that the king had. Daniel wouldn't stop saying his prayers and turning toward Jerusalem as he should. And so he says, say ye to the righteous that it shall be well with him, for they shall eat the fruit of their doings. And so we see how it was with Daniel and his friends. They were given high positions of authority in Babylon. They lived a life that was probably far above what they would have had right here in Judea.